Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Vice President Kamala Harris's ascension to the top of the Democratic ticket has been breathtaking. Breathtaking in the speed with which she garnered support, breathtaking in her impact on the polls, and especially breathtaking in how she has infused enthusiasm, at least on the part of Democrats, back into the presidential race. Of course, it's still early in her candidacy, and a lot can happen in the 90-plus days before the election, but her impact is undeniable. One traditional Democratic constituency has been black voters, particularly black women voters. They have been described as the backbone of the party. We were told that despite their contribution to President Biden's election success 4 years ago, many black voters, especially black men, were looking around, some even gravitating toward Donald Trump in this election cycle. Is that still the case, or has the prospect of a Harris presidency recaptured their attention? And if so, what influence might black voters have on the outcome of the 2024 election? We explore that this hour with Bakari Sellers. He is a South Carolina attorney and politician who serves as a political commentator for CNN. He's also the author of several books, the latest of which was released this past spring, The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We All Can Move Forward. Bakari Sellers, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again, Mike. It's an honor to be here with you.
You're welcome. Mary C. Curtis is also back with us. She's a frequent contributor to this program's weekly news roundup. She's also a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Mike.
And we welcome Christine Edwards for the first time. She is the founder and principal consultant of Civility Localized. That's a community engagement consulting firm that helps to build a bridge between government and community. Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Bakari, I'm going to start with you, and I don't mean to pick on you, but I just saw a video clip of you a couple of hours ago in which it was, I think it was 2 weeks ago on CNN, a little over 2 weeks ago on CNN, in which you said voters have three choices in this contest. They can either vote for President Biden, Donald Trump, or sit it out. What happened?
Yeah, you know, things changed. I would always tell people that you have three choices, and those three choices remain the same, right? It's either Kamala Harris, it's either Donald Trump or the couch. And those three choices remain the same. I know that I was shocked, I guess it's 8 days ago now. My world is spinning so fast. Slightly after I left Waffle House that morning, getting my kids breakfast. If that's not a Southern staple, I don't know what is. But after I left Waffle House, I went home and was preparing to write up, and I saw President Biden's letter that he wasn't running for election. And it completely changed the landscape of and tone and tenor of what we're seeing today and unleashed a world of energy.
Yeah, there were predictions about what this might do, a change at the top of the ticket might do to the Democratic Party's chances. There were predictions that the Democratic Party would be in disarray. There was much concern about anointing the vice president to take over at the top of the ticket. All of that vanished almost immediately, Bakari. Did that surprise you?
There was some work that had been going on behind the scenes, myself and Donna Brazile and others. The thesis of that work, though, was that we're firmly behind Joe Biden. And if he makes that decision that you are not going to run, then you're not going to skip over the first black female vice president in the history of the country. You're just simply not going to do that. And people were rallying around her, and it coalesced quicker. And in September 2016, Hillary Clinton raised $150 million that month. In 8 days, Kamala Harris raised $200 million. To give us some perspective, 140,000 volunteers, the energy you've seen, the polling you've seen. Now, she's still an underdog. Let's not act like she's winning this race. She's still an underdog, but the energy is just totally different, and she's on a trajectory that could propel her to be president of the United States.
Mary, $200 million is nothing to scoff at. What does that tell you?
Well, it says that there is so much enthusiasm and also a sense of relief. The poll showed that there were a lot of people, the so-called double haters, who did not want this rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. They were exhausted. They thought they're two older men, and couldn't we do with someone different, something different? So you saw that excitement come out. And also, you know, the landscape has changed so much. People refer to when she was running Kamala Harris in 2020 and her campaign didn't do well. But think of all the things that have happened since then, the Dobbs decision, things like that. So she has been, her voice has been out there, especially on that issue of abortion and abortion rights, which Joe Biden really had a problem talking about. And, you know, she is a younger person. She could excite voters of color, young people. You see her winning the so-called meme wars on social media. And those Zoom calls that came together, that was incredible. You had the Black women coming together and the white women saying, hey, we can outdo that. A friend of mine was on a South Asian Men for Kamala Harris call on Saturday, raising that money. And then we just had the white dudes for Harris, you know, kicked off by the dude himself, Jeff Bridges. So we just see that excitement. Also, one thing that I've heard, well, word I've heard a lot is joy, because they were making memes about her laughing, that Republicans were, and people realized people wanted somebody laughing. They wanted that joy. Have you ever seen Donald Trump laugh? He smirks, maybe. He makes fun of people. So it was just as if there was a collective, you know, breath.
Yeah. There were 53,000 people, I think, on the Black Men for Harris Zoom call. I didn't know you could have that many people on a Zoom connection. It's almost more viewers than CNN and MSNBC have combined sometimes on some nights. Christina Edwards, I'm curious about something. The excitement about this candidacy of Kamala Harris has expanded beyond racial and beyond gender barriers, as Mary just alluded to, although that's certainly part of it. How would you compare what this means, this candidacy means, to what the president, to what Barack Obama's candidacy meant back in that election cycle, 2008, I think it was?
Sure. I think that there are some similarities, because when you think about the generation that first voted in the 2008 Obama campaign, which I'm a part of that generation, firmly in the millennial, you know, generation, I was on campus at UNC Greensboro in 2008 campaigning and walking through the streets, you know, Obama 08, let's be part of something great. I think that the folks in my generation were looking for that same type of energy. And now we have new technology. We have Zoom, we have virtual voter engagement. And if you pair that with the disenfranchisement that has happened over this sort of decade, I think that's how you're energizing these thousands and thousands of voters. I learned about the Win with Black Women call through a group text, right? So I think that the voter engagement is happening at the, you know, at the community level with our friends at our kitchen tables. And so those are the types of places that these conversations need to be happening.
Well, since you're the youngest one here, one of the things that has been commented on in this cycle with Kamala Harris is that she and her campaign have embraced social media, and they have taken on the memes that have been issued about her and put their arms around them. Is that going to make a difference, the fact that she's into this?
I think it makes somewhat of a difference. You know, just on the surface level, it helps to kind of spread that awareness and get eyeballs. But I think that the more that you dig away and learn about VP Harris as a leader and as a candidate, the more you realize the similarities that she shares with everyday Americans. You know, the fact that she is a stepmom, the fact that she is a sister and grew up with her sister in the home, and the fact that she is an HBCU student. And I also resonate with the fact that she is a public servant, right? And the fact that she went on to be a prosecutor, thinking and hoping that she can make a difference from within. You know, that's how I got my background, was working in local government. And a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to be on your side because you work on behalf of the government. But having that optimism, that hope, I think that energizes a lot of people as well.
Bakari Sellers, Christine may have already answered this question, but I'd like to get your perspective on it because you were, I believe I'm right in saying that you were the co-chair of the Kamala Harris for President campaign when she was running against in the field of Democrats that Joe Biden ultimately won 4 years ago. What's different this time around? Because the excitement this time around is palpable.
Yeah, we kind of screwed that up the first time. I think that's the difference. We put her in bubble wrap, and that was, what I always tell people is the Kamala Harris I know and the Kamala Harris that the world saw in 2020 are not the same person, and that was our fault. We were a little too gentle with her. And what I've told the vice president and what I've told Tony West and Julie Rodriguez and everyone who will listen to people who are running her campaign and who I speak to on a daily basis is go big and go bold. There is, democracy's on the line. If we're going to make a mistake, make a big mistake. That didn't happen in 2020. And this is also a different time. I kind of reject the comparison a little bit between Barack Obama and Kamala Harris because I think it's unfair to both of them, really. And this is a different animal. I mean, John McCain is not Donald Trump by any stretch. And I think John McCain is probably saluting me from heaven for saying that. It's a different type of atmosphere. It's a different beast that Kamala Harris is running up against. And to the point that Christine made, which was so profound, this is there is one in, there's one there's one campaign that is engulfed kind of in the language of fear, utilizing fear as a motivating capacity. And you see the ads, they're darkness, they're fire. You hear the language talking about the doldrums of despair that the country's in. And then there's the Kamala Harris campaign, which has to be a campaign focused on freedom, on joy, on looking forward. But also uniquely, Mike, one of the things we haven't addressed and we have some time and maybe we'll get to it is one of Kamala's team is rightfully moving away from the messaging around the history of her candidacy because you can see that, right? You can see the history and who she is. But we have to target people, Mike, who look like you and who are in the suburbs and exurbs and tell them what Kamala Harris can do for them. We can see the history in her candidacy. The question is, how is she going to win and build that coalition?
She also has to tell Mary what she can do for African American voters because before she emerged as the front runner, there was all this concern in the Democratic Party about particularly black men gravitating toward Donald Trump. Has she been tainted by whatever tainted Joe Biden, or can she move beyond it?
Well, first, I want to say that black voters are not a monolith.
Right.
They slice up white voters, soccer moms, this, that, lunch pail dads, and they're not. So it's not just based on gender, but are you or live in a city or a suburb? Are you a small business owner? But I do think that when it comes to African American voters, that it was thought that the Democratic Party depended on them, but somehow and sometimes took them for granted. So they just want, Democratic leaders to actually take their concerns very seriously and listen to them. And actually, among many Black women that I have spoken with, they were very, very protective of Biden, and they appreciated the fact that he did some things that Barack Obama didn't do. He had Kamala Harris as his running mate. He put Ketanji Brown Jackson on the Supreme Court. And so I think that she will be leaning into not only what the plans are, but also how Biden-era policies really did benefit Black voters and Black citizens in a very profound way.
When we come back, there's a lot to talk about in terms of the excitement that has built around the Harris candidacy and why and in what quarters that excitement is really concentrated, plus other things that we'll talk about with Bakari Sellers, Mary C. Curtis, and Christine Edwards. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Bakari Sellers, CNN political commentator and author. Mary C. Curtis is here. She's the columnist from RollCall.com, who also hosts their Equal Time podcast. And Christine Edwards is the founder and principal consultant with an organization called Civility Localized. Christine, Black women have been described as the key constituency for Democrats. And you were quoted recently in the Charlotte Observer as saying, there's this phenomenon of Black women being brought in to fix things when they've gone horribly wrong, rather than people just believing in us and hiring us and electing us in the first place. If other Black women share that opinion, and I'm sure they do, does Kamala Harris' candidacy address those concerns?
I think that those concerns point to a specific, a little bit of a fear. When the announcement was first made on the 21st, there's that fear that this racism and misogyny that is deep-seated in this country is going to be shared throughout, you know, throughout her campaign. And this idea of Black women being brought in the workplace and in politics, it's not something that we just made up. It is a phenomenon. It is also sort of known as the glass ceiling, this idea of not the glass ceiling, but also the glass cliff, the idea that you get to a certain point and you're not able to see what's next. You're set up to fail, right? There's also this idea, and I apologize, I don't know the author, but the idea of pet to threat. It is when a Black woman ascends to a level of leadership and in an organization or workplace, and she's the pet, right? She's doted upon and her ideas are celebrated. But then after a level of success is achieved, then she's turned into a threat, right? And so this is an experience that I and probably many other Black women have experienced. And so that kind of leans over to, you know, what VP Harris is could be experiencing as well.
Mary.
And I wanted to say, and following up on both what Christine and Bakari said, Kamala Harris isn't leaning into her identity as a first, but it doesn't mean it's not. Republicans certainly are. We went to the point where the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, actually warned the leaders in the Republican Party, saying, please go after just her policies. Don't do any of this DEI attacks, unqualified attacks. But of course, they couldn't help it. And we see Trump doing this as well, where they are doing these familiar tropes, these attacks, hoping, because with J.D. Vance and Trump at the top of the ticket, they really, you know, Hulk Hogan ripping off his shirt, they went for that white guy kind of vibe. And now they are really attacking her. And, you know, at the same time, as Christine said, Black women are a little bit fearful, protective, but they also know that she is prepared because she's been doing that. And also the fact that many of the Republicans might go too far and turn off all kinds of people with these attacks, which we've seen have gotten very disgusting. I mean, Trump is calling her a bum, these kinds of things. People are saying, looking into her LSATs, her law school grades. And when people really are concerned about policy, this might be the wrong way to go. And as far as Black women being called on to rescue the world, we see a Black and South Asian woman being called on to save what, democracy?
Well, yes. So Bakari, as you said, she is not a shoo-in. She is an underdog here, but she certainly has energized the race on both sides of the aisle. She's energized Democrats, made them enthusiastic, given them some reason for excitement. And it's given the other side reason to really ramp up their efforts, because they thought they had this in the bag. When President Obama ran for office, he was successful in large part because of the assembly of a coalition of voters that included various different voting blocks, African-Americans, women, young voters. What sort of coalition, if any, does Kamala Harris have to assemble if she hopes to win?
Yeah, so, you know, hopefully she's able to cross that 40% threshold with white voters. If she does that, she'll be president of the United States. But the coalition also includes younger voters. You do know that Black and brown voters will be there. You're seeing Hispanic women run to Kamala Harris's side in high numbers, particularly in the state of Florida. So that is something that's happening. Men, Hispanic men, are not moving with the same speed of voracity as women are. And you're going to see white college educated women. And that's why places like Charlotte, North Carolina, are so important, because white college educated women, the areas and places like Monroe or Concord, those areas that are on the exurbs or suburbs, are going to be very important to our coalition. It's a little different than Barack Obama's coalition, but a lot of the themes are still the same.
But she is exciting women, she is exciting minorities, and she's undeniably exciting young people, Christine. So what does that tell you?
I think that what this tells me, especially in regard to young people, is that, just as Bakari said, we're going to show up. This is an opportunity for young people to show up and to really just get behind a candidate. I think that also people might not be thinking about overturning of Roe v. Wade, right? So thinking about the importance of Black maternal health, getting those really health aspects back into it. A lot of young people care about that as well. So I definitely think that in terms of policies, people are going to be looking at her policy in the same way that they're looking at her personality and her identity.
I'm not sure why some black men were gravitating toward Donald Trump before the announcement of Kamala Harris's candidacy as opposed to Joe Biden, but is her candidacy likely to increase black voter turnout, enchant black males to come back into the Democratic fold? Will it, if she wins, ultimately translate to their hopes and dreams and desires being addressed in a Harris presidency, or will they be disappointed, as some have been, by what happened with Joe Biden? And I'm not sure why they're disappointed, but that apparently is the case.
You're putting a lot on her shoulders, if and when.
Yeah.
But let's just say Trump has a ceiling, and he won with that ceiling in 2016, and he lost with it in 2020. And a lot of it is turnout. And that's what it's not only exciting women, exciting younger voters, exciting Black folks, but will they come out and vote? We've seen in North Carolina, excuse me, Democrats get oh so close, but because the turnout was low. And I do see that excitement there. We saw the Black men on the call, and we've seen in the polls so far, and polls are just a snapshot, that the increasing number of Black men and Black women who are favoring voting for Kamala Harris, well, we've seen it increase. And I saw a snippet from a pastor who said, folks, Black men are going to be very put off when you insult w a Black woman. So that is really not a way to go. And so these attacks aren't really, helping. And as far as suburban women, an unscientific survey, when I go to my gym, which is suburban white women for the most part, they came up to me in excitement. Some have volunteers. What can we do? They had listened to the Slate podcast I hosted on DEI yesterday and those attacks with Brittany Cooper. That's terrible. How can they do that to such a wonderful woman? So, we'll see who comes to the polls and what they do in the booth, but she will be working with a team if and when she gets elected. And I think that she knows what she needs to do. She would build on
Yeah.
what the Biden administration was doing.
Bakari.
Yeah. First of all, I think that the narrative that black men were going to Trump is a little misguided. I think that we've heard that a lot. I was with former Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy on Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO, and he brought that up. And my response to him was somewhat flippant, but true, I guess. Because if you thought that Donald Trump was getting 20% of the black vote, I had a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. All right. The biggest threat to Joe Biden, like Kamala Harris's biggest threat when it comes to black voters, is the couch. And there were a lot of black men who were just willing to sit this out for something that Mary, who is now our unscientific pollster at her gym and other places, there were a lot of men who, and she said this earlier, who just didn't feel as if either party catered to their needs. And there was a lot of focus on black women, but what was there for black men was the question. I helped organize that call on last Monday of black men. Myself, Quentin James, Khalil Thompson, and Roland Martin started on a Sunday night, just the four of us, through social media, just a few emails from our email list. We grew to 53,000 Black men on that call and raised $1.4 million, right? You talk about the pastor that Mary mentioned earlier. You're starting to see this groundswell, and what it comes from are just these age-old themes that we want to be the head of our households. And that means being a provider and being a protector. We want to be the backbone of our communities. And you're seeing people resonate with those really age-old themes and coming out and doing the work necessary for Kamala Harris.
Can we talk about race in this for just a moment, in this race? When Barack Obama ran and won, much was made of the fact that he was our first Black president, but in fact, he was of mixed heritage. His mother was white. She would be our first Black female president, but she's of mixed heritage. Her mother was Indian, Asian Indian. And I'm curious as to what role race is playing, should play, in this, and how dangerous that might be because of whatever potential backlash there may be to this. The first thing out of the block that we talked about here was the 40,000 plus women, Black women on a Zoom call, followed by the 53,000 Black men Zoom call, Bakari, that you helped organize. Is that playing into the accusation on the part of Republicans that Democrats play identity politics?
So I think that it plays into it somewhat, but it's not when in terms of race and Black American culture, I think that this is not necessarily about her parentage, but about her experience as a Black American and also her experience in the political arena and the policies that have been supported for Black people in America. I think that people are able to look at her and see that she is a person of color and be able to resonate with that. You know, they say you can't be what you don't see, right? So with Ketanji Brown Jackson being appointed to the Supreme Court, that leads us to believe that there may be other Supreme Court justices that are added that whether they're Black or not, they're gonna have Black people's needs in mind, right? So I definitely think it plays into it for young people and for Black people. But I don't, again, I think what Kari mentioned, I don't know that she's leaning into it. I think because we've seen Black political leadership in the past, it doesn't have that air of newness as much as it has in the past.
Let me flip the coin on that question, Bakari, because a lot of people felt with the election of Barack Obama, we had entered a new era, a post-racial era, and we've quickly found out that was not the case. In fact, race is very much a part of a lot of things. But would a second Black president, a Black woman in this case, take race out of the equation going forward forevermore? Would we be
so
beyond
now you-
that?
Now you want her to save democracy and end racism?
I'm just asking you what it happened.
Mike, how strong do you think this one?
Oh, my God. I want to take a nap.
Does she get lunch first?
I mean, who's paying?
Probably her, based upon
this. Yes.
The answer is no, because, first of all, I think that a lot of my Republican colleagues are utilizing the race card more than you can ever imagine because they don't know how to react to Kamala Harris. And I think that you have talked about this, Mike. I know Miss Mary's talked about this as well, but using the word DEI hire, calling her a bum, calling her a ding dong. You've had people go on Fox News and just make some of the most derogatory sexual claims you can ever imagine and then laugh about it, right? Or just fundamentally mispronouncing her name. And for listeners out there, her name is Kama, like the comma, and then La. It ain't that difficult, Kama La. And it's those type of things that, and then what you're gonna begin to see is more of the Willie Horton era attacks on her. And for those who may not remember, Willie Horton was a prominent role in the 1988 Dukakis campaign of a parolee who subsequently went out and committed more violent crimes, and it basically scared white folk to death. And so you're going to see a lot of that from times as prosecutor and try to scare voters into voting for. So I would actually say that the issue of race is more prevalent in the attacks against Kamala Harris than the issue of race is being utilized for Kamala Harris. And she won't be able to destroy the systems of injustice, inequality, and oppression in 4 years of presidency. They've taken hundreds of years to develop, she can't do it as 4 years of being president.
I think she may have him between a rock and a hard place, because I think that I could be wrong about this, but I think that one of the Republican people, and it could have been Donald Trump, mentioned that she doesn't like Jews. Well, she's married to a Jewish man, so clearly that is not the case. But she, what was the question I was going to ask? It's gone. Mary?
I just wanted to jump in real quick and say, I know very few people who said after Obama was elected that we are in a post-racial society. That was wishful thinking. And if you look at how perfect he had to be with his family, and what did they follow it up with? Trump, a person with his character. And I think in a sense, he made that possible because that was part of the backlash. And also something you said about identity politics, that is a charge that's put on the Democrats. But look at, is the Republican ticket white male identity politics? And now as they're talking about who will Kamala Harris pick as her vice president, they're saying, well, she has to pick a white guy from a Midwest or a swing state. So it seems like that tag is only used, as is DEI, when it's a person of color, to point out the otherness and to put them in a box where it really, they've been balancing tickets forever.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask Christine had to deal with the rock and a hard place that the Republicans find themselves in, because if they can make these comments that are derogatory about her being a DEI hire all day on Fox News and amongst their own base at the convention and elsewhere, but will that play beyond the base, or will it actually work against them? Because not only are you insulting a black person, you're insulting a black woman. So you've got two coalitions there that may not take kindly to that kind of talk, and certainly won't attract them. It might, in fact, repel them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why they're being asked not to play into that too much and not to, call her necessarily a DEI hire. I think you're not only insulting Black women, but also Black political leaders, attorneys, people that, she's been in this position for 4 years and has made an incredible amount of change within the Biden administration. And also, when you think about the actual policies that have been able to pass under this Supreme Court, for example, ending affirmative action has really just released a Pandora's box of DEI and anti-DEI and racist policies at the state level.
And their decision on Dobbs also has a lot of women in general just really ticked off. And that's something that the Democrats were planning to run on. They have other things they can run on in addition to that now. We'll talk about those and more when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the candidacy of Kamala Harris and what that has done to the race, the presidential race, with Bakari Sellers, CNN political commentator, author, and attorney. Mary C. Curtis is with us from RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Christine Edwards is the founder of and principal consultant at Civility Localized. We have an email from Andrew who says, I'm an old school Republican who has found himself without a party for some time now. I'll admit I wasn't a fan of Harris a few years ago, but she has really grown on me in the last 10 days. She is a sigh of relief that many of us needed. She is personable, and I'm proud to say my first donation to a Democratic presidential candidate is to Vice President Harris and will proudly vote for her in November, which takes us back to the rock and hard place comment that I made about Republicans and how they deal with her, particularly Donald Trump, who is known to make a habit of throwing shade and hurling insults at political rivals. And he's done that already with Kamala Harris, calling into question even where she was born, as he did with Barack Obama. She was born, by the way, in California. About Hillary Clinton, he said, the only card she has is the woman card. He has denigrated women of color as angry or nasty. So does he run the risk, Bakari, of strengthening support for her by using that kind of approach?
Yes, but I also just want to be extremely clear, Mike, that Kamala Harris is going to be the next president of the United States, not because she's a black woman, but because she's the best candidate. And I think that a lot of people are realizing that since 2016, we've been in this perpetual state of fear. We've been in this perpetual state of despair. And I'm just tired of people talking down about this country in ways that are unrecognizable to me. And Kamala is talking about words like freedom. She's talking about not just where she was as a prosecutor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but also what this country should be. And Donald Trump, at 78 years old, and this is ironic for me to say, as somebody who was supporting Joe Biden 8 days ago, but is the oldest person in the history of American politics to run for president of the United States. And one thing that Donald Trump is unable to give you, and give me in particular, is a vision for what this country should look like. For my twins who are 5.5 years old. And maybe it's because it's hard for someone 78. I'm not trying to be ageist, but maybe it's hard for someone 78 to give a vision for the future because that's a vision that they may not be a part of. But he's unable to do that. And Kamala Harris has to do that and do that clearly. And I think she will.
And she's young, so she has a future. And that's part of the equation here, I suppose. You talk about this dystopian picture that has been painted by Donald Trump, should he lose. And I'm sorry, you're talking, but your mic is off.
No, I was saying that's the word I was thinking about, Mike.
Okay.
That's dystopian. I could,
Yeah.
that's the SAT word I was looking for. Thank you.
You're welcome. But you talk about this dystopian future, but and it's also compounded by the fact that politics has always been characterized on both sides by hyperbole. You want to sell your case in the strongest possible terms to get people's attention who are only half listening most of the time. And so that's taken hold. But with Donald Trump, he's taken it to a new level because almost every word out of his mouth, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, is a lie. It's simply not true what he's saying. According to The Guardian, a vast majority of Black Americans trust Kamala Harris and distrust Donald Trump, 71% compared to 5%, according to the largest known survey of Black Americans since the Reconstruction era. Given Trump's proclivity for telling falsehoods almost about everything, it's certainly easy to understand that distrust, Christine. But what is it about Harris that makes people trust her?
I think that it's a combination of the results that she's been able to garner over the past 4 years in her leadership position, but also when, again, the juxtaposition between VP Harris and the other candidate, and also that candidate's choice for vice president. What a huge disconnect, I think, between when we talk about age, right? And you hear people, when you hear JD Vance say something about childless women, right? Especially when you have millennial women waiting longer to start families and starting families at a lower rate. And so that's a choice that we get to make and that young people get to make. And we want to continue to be able to make those choices. So I think that juxtaposition is really helping people make those decisions and instill trust in VP Harris as a candidate.
Aside from the religious and social tropes that he seems to engage in, the candidate, J.D. Vance, for vice president, he does, I think he was chosen in large part to strike a chord among people who feel left out of this economy, which is doing very well, actually, but people think that it's not because they are not experiencing it necessarily in their personal lives. The number one concern among Black voters is low wages and, by extension, other economic concerns. An April NBC News poll revealed that one-third of Black respondents said the economy had not improved under Joe Biden, and 6 in 10 of them, 60%, said they felt their family income could not meet the cost of living. Despite the Biden-Harris administration's considerable efforts to turn things around post-pandemic, as well as considerable number of actual successes, a whole lot of Americans feel the same way that those Black Americans do. It's not helping them. Bakari, how likely is that to impact their support of Kamala Harris? Because she'll bring with her, one would presume, 4 more years of the same or very similar policies.
One of the first policies that she outlined, Mike, was a promise not to raise taxes on people who make under $400,000. And so One of the questions that we have to ask ourselves, and you were so right, Mike, because the issue is not inflation. I hate when people couch it as such. The issue is cost. The cost of goods, the cost of gas, right? My daddy called me mad, and you'll appreciate this. My daddy called me mad. And he doesn't really get mad, but he was so mad at the price of whiting in our Piggly Wiggly in Denmark, South Carolina. He could not believe the cost of it. He was like, I've been eating whiting my entire life. Why am I paying $10? Like, so he, you know, true, and he ain't voting for nobody else but Kamala Harris, big Democrat, et cetera. But, you know, even he identified that issue. She has to be able to address that clearly. And she has to put forth policies to say that we're going to continue, because right now we are seeing a decrease in cost, right? We are seeing all economic indicators go in the right direction. But until people feel it, it's not a real thing. And she has to continue to speak to that and act as if she hears that pain. And my bet is that she does.
And Mary, there are things about what Donald Trump has espoused economically, like tariffs on all goods coming into this country. We pay the tariffs. The countries involved, China is not going to pay a tariff on goods coming in from China. We are going to pay that. And there are other things that Project 2025, which is a publication by the Heritage Foundation, that conservative think tank, a 900-page blueprint for the next conservative presidential administration that proposes a lot of things that would make things economically worse for the average American. It would upend the nation as we know it. Among the things it would end, it proposes to end school meal programs. It proposes to make it more difficult to qualify and keep SNAP benefits. It proposes striking from the vocabulary any mention of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Do the black voters who know about these provisions in Project 2025 see them as attack on black Americans, on poor people?
I think voters of every color look at some of the things in this 900 plus page document, which is a blueprint, which is why the Trump administration has been trying to distance itself, which is hard to do when so many people in his administration helped to write it. And J.D. Vance has wrote the foreword to the book of the person from the Heritage Foundation. And I think that's very smart on their part, because you can say Project 2025, but when you say things like ending school lunches and things like that, and you can back it up with what Republicans have done in
And I
states
should
where
and I
they've
should point
turned
out
money
that
down.
I should point out that Project 2025 refers to school lunches as wasteful.
Yeah, they also really attack public schools, and it's not just cities, but in rural areas, you don't have a bunch of private schools. They depend on public schools. Ending Head Start, which has helped children. Jailing librarians who put the wrong books in the library, who get attacked, ending a lot of civil rights protections. They wanted to go back to when employers can discriminate, not just on the basis of race, but age, ability, or any creed, all of these things. So I think that's very smart that they are focusing on these policies and how that would really affect folks' day-to-day lives.
Unless you agree with those policy positions, it seems to me that they are impinging on freedoms and rights we've taken for granted in this country, and that could be characterized as tyranny. Because if you don't agree with them and you have to comply with them, that's tyrannical. And yet they call Joe Biden and his administration tyrannical. Christine, explain this to me. How can that be possible?
Oh, well, I'm not going to go down the road of explaining tyranny. But I think that what's happening and what you can glean from this is going back to those group chat, group text conversations and talking to your neighbor, talking to your good friend, talking to the people in your neighborhood about what's going on. Using Project 2025 as a book club, right? Taking pieces of it and sharing and peeling back the layers and reading what's actually going on, so we can educate ourselves about what what Trump and what their people want to do, in 2025. So I think educating ourselves is going to be very important. And also look at what's already been done in terms of affirmative action. We know that white women are the largest beneficiaries of affirmative action. And so now that it's been, you know, repealed at the state level, and you now have colleges and universities getting rid of affirmative action. So just look at the ripple effect of what's going on, and people will then begin to wake up and become active voters.
Yeah, and in the same way that Bakari talked about, basically, Kamala Harris is the underdog. In a sense, Donald Trump is sort of like an incumbent because we know what he will do. So all those folks who in 2016 said, I don't really like Hillary Clinton, I can't bring myself to vote for her, and you heard this on the White Women's Call, they are now saying, well, what did that give us? Three Supreme Court justices that overturned Roe v. Wade. So it's not just that... Kamala Harris is kind of a different candidate in that way, but we are a different country, and people can look back and see what happened under a Donald Trump presidency and what's going to happen with Project 2025. And it is, as it is our favorite word, a dystopian future.
Yeah, and I'm glad Mike brought that word into the discussion, because I was searching for it in my head for the first 40 minutes of the call. But you know, when you look at Project 2025, it actually lays forth policy that takes us back to a place that the four of us, I would argue, don't want to go, right? And I think that's something that people have to keep in mind. Over 900 pages, 30 chapters, 140 people from Trump's world, nearly half of those 140 people have different misogynistic, racist writings in their past. That's just not a place where we want to go. And whether or not it's a nationwide ban on abortion or eliminating a free lunch program, or they even have a problem with veterans benefits. I mean, what are we doing here? And I think the question a lot of young people are saying is that that's not an America I want to live in.
Yeah. And even some of the older people are looking and saying, you're going to mess with my Social Security and Medicare? That's a way to get a lot of people to the polls.
Right. Absolutely. And I even read something about getting rid of organizations like the EPA, looking at these agencies that have kept regulations in place. And when it comes to climate change, obviously that's something that we should have been looking at 10 years ago, 20 years ago, right? And so having a potential administration come in that is going to get rid of those regulations, it's going to make it harder to actually live on this planet.
Especially with the Supreme Court decisions that they're coming out with now, government agencies, you know, judges can decide if the regulations on clean air and water are actually legitimate. So we are de-emphasizing expertise, and we're promoting the political clout. And when you see the plans to fire all of these civil service workers and put in political appointees, and let's face it, so many African Americans, when they couldn't get jobs in private companies, they would take that civil service test. And that was also a way into the middle class. So any way you look at it, they're attacking it, they're attacking American people, with particularly people of color and poor people, elderly, the disabled. It's an incredible view of the world.
Dystopian, I think, is the word.
I'm going to dream about that tonight, Bakari.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that's coming up, and I think that the imagery will be extremely important, is September 10th. And I hope people listening keep that date in mind. That's the date of the ABC debate that probably is going to look a little different, because just yesterday, Kamala Harris said she would show up, but President Trump said, nah, I think I'm going to just sit this one out. And so you're going to have the imagery, if they ever end up on stage together, of what the future looks like versus what yesterday looks like. And I think if they're able to get on that stage, I'm very interested to see. And I think we'll be able to hear a lot of the same attacks. We'll be interested to see how he reacts to a woman of color standing that close to him with that level of brilliance, talking to him about his failures to his face, but also clearly articulating a vision for the future that is different from his vision. And I'm interested to see his reaction to that and the reaction of many other viewers. And she's going to be more than well prepared, I can tell you that much.
And I don't think he's going to be stalking her like he did Hillary Clinton walking around on the stage. I think I can predict that. And
I was going to say, I have a funny story about that, because when Kamala Harris was preparing in 2020 for her run for the presidency, one of the things that came about was if you're in a debate and he with him and he talks you like this, what would you do? And her response was that she would simply look at him and say, that's weird. And so that's that's weird came from, that people are now saying.
CNN political commentator Bakari Sellers, also the author of The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We All Can Move Forward. He was here along with Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Christine Edwards, founder and principal consultant with Civility Localized. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.